Christian comedian Ken Davis tells this story about waiting for a sign from God. A Christian gets on an empty city bus and he walks back to the rear of the bus and he sits down. Lord, he prays, if you want me to speak to someone about you, please give me a sign today. At the next stop, another passenger boards the bus, goes all the way to the back of this empty bus, and sits down next to the one man that's on the bus, this Christian. And the passenger turns to him and he says, do you know anything about Jesus? The Christian excuses himself for a moment, bows his head, and once again prays, Lord, if you really want me to talk to this stranger, I need just one more sign. Please turn the bus driver into an armadillo. Have you been praying for any armadillos lately? Have you been waiting for a sign from God that you really hope never actually comes? Before you get serious about following Him and walking with Him by faith, to fix whatever it is before you follow Him, to give you a sign, are you praying for armadillos? Faith means following God wherever He leads. We could add whenever He leads. And sometimes without a specific plan laid out before us. Hebrews says that Abraham went not knowing where he was going. That's faith. Now, I am such a rationalistic, task-oriented planner, plan-driven personality, that sometimes in my life, there's no room for God to lead in my plans. Can you identify with me? I'm really not living by faith. I'm living by my plans. And God has to interrupt those plans to get me to do what He wants me to do sometimes. You know, sometimes I think it takes the proverbial 2x4 to my head. And then I say, oh, that's what you want, God. Well, Abram was a bit like that, I think. God called Abram to leave his family, to go to Canaan. And God called him while he was still living in Ur of the Chaldees, and we talked about that last Sunday. The family did move, led by Terah, Abram's father. They moved, but they settled in Haran, in northern Mesopotamia. And the verb in the Hebrew text back in chapter 11 is they settled in Haran. In fact, Abram probably lived there for roughly 30 years. That's a pretty good settlement. I'm sure he had his reasons. His father was elderly. The family needed him. Business was good. But he wasn't really following God, was he? He wasn't going where God wanted him to go. That was Canaan, a foreign country. And in Genesis chapter 12, where we pick up this morning, we have a recall. We have Abraham's recall here. This is a second calling of Abraham. God calls him a second time, and this time Abram obeys. He follows God. So principle number one, we are successful as we trust God's promises. Chapter 12 of Genesis, verses 1 through 3. Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you. And the one who curses you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So God asks Abram to do some pretty unreasonable things here. God calls him to leave his country, his relatives, his father's house, and go to a land that God will show him when he gets there. The border to Abraham's country was the Euphrates River near the city of Carchemish. Once he crossed that river, he was walking into foreign country, foreign territory. Leave everything you are familiar with and the lifestyle that you now enjoy and your family and your friends and everything that you know and are comfortable with, and follow me to a place you do not know and a life you cannot even imagine yet. Whoa, God, really? Come on. That's unreasonable. That's not rational. That's not logical. I've got family. I've got people to take care of. But here's the thing. Real success comes when we follow God, even when it seems unreasonable. Now, from an earthly point of view, Abram will never be very successful in his life. His brother Nahor, on the other hand, was very successful. If years later you were to ask the family there in the area, the family friends, the people who knew the family, about the two sons of Terah, Nahor would have been well known. In fact, he settles down there in the region of northern Mesopotamia, and he builds a great city, and the city is named after him. We find that out in Genesis chapter 24, when Abram sends his servant back to the city of Nahor in upper Mesopotamia to find a bride for his son Isaac. Nahor was a success. The whole city was named after him. Abram? You got to be kidding me. He was a wanderer. Never settled down. Never did anything with his life. That's what people would say. Yet God knew better. By man's standards, Abram was a failure. By God's standards, Abram was the success. God called Abram to an unreasonable journey. But God gave Abram some staggering promises in these verses. A great legacy is going to result from his obedience, but he must trust God and God's promises and obey God's call. Seven promises in these verses. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great. You shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse those who curse you. And all the families of the earth will be blessed in you. Those are some pretty staggering promises made to Abram. It's what we call the Abrahamic covenant. It is a unilateral covenant. It is not unconditional. Sometimes we hear that, but it's not an unconditional covenant, because the only way to enjoy it is by obedience. But it is a unilateral covenant, meaning that God alone made the contract. God makes these promises to Abram and to his descendants, and they are promises for all time. They're for all of history. There is no end point, you notice, in these promises. So God promises to make a great nation out of Abram, and we know that nation to be the nation of Israel. God continues to keep his promise to this day. God promises to bless Abram and to make his name great. And all over this world, Abraham's name is well known. Abram is honored today. He has been a blessing to so many down through history, so you shall be a blessing. And God promises to bless those who bless him and curse those who curse him. And that applies, of course, to Abraham's descendants, the nation of Israel. God continues to keep that promise to this day. Nations that turn their backs on Israel receive God's cursing. And those who bless Israel, God's people, receive God's blessing. That's been true historically. I personally believe that America has been blessed because we have stood with God's people, God's chosen people, the Jews. And the day we turn our backs on God's people is the day God turns His back on us too as a nation. For He promised it, I will bless those who bless you, I will curse those who curse you. And we must always bless Israel if we want God's blessing. Now, that does not mean, of course, that we have to agree with every decision that the nation of Israel makes. It is largely, quite frankly, a secular nation today. But we must not turn our backs on God's people, for they are God's chosen people, if we want God's blessing. The last promise shows God's heart for the whole world. It is the gospel in a promise. God promises that all the nations of this world will be blessed through Abraham. We know from the New Testament that this ultimately is a promise of Messiah, Jesus. He is the promised seed through whom the entire world will be blessed. So here we have the gospel in a promise. So Abram had to trust God's promises to follow God's call. Great call, but great promises. And the same is true for us today. We will be successful as God measures success. Now, not as the world measures success, but as God measures success, we will be successful as we trust God's promises and obey God's call. It may not always seem reasonable. It may not always seem rational by our world's standards. We may not understand, really, and sometimes we question why God is leading us in certain directions, but we can trust Him, even when we do not fully understand what God is doing. And that's the way a Christian has to walk in this life. No matter what you're struggling with, you have to trust Him to walk you through it and to obey His call on your life. And to use where you are for His glory. And any new directions to follow Him. Os Guinness, in his book Unspeakable, points to an example that was presented by Oxford philosopher Basil Mitchell in what was called the Parable of the Resistance Leader. Imagine that you are in German-occupied France during World War II. And you would like to join the resistance movement there against Nazi Germany's control. And one day in a bar, you're sitting there and a man comes up to you, introduces himself, and he's the resistance leader for that area. And so for several hours, you talk with this resistance leader quietly. He finds out about you and you find out about him. And the duties that you would have to perform as a member of the resistance there in France. He explains the requirements, all of that, but then he gives you a warning. You can back out now, but if you join, your life will be at risk. This will be the only face-to-face meeting you ever have. From here on, you don't know me. You will receive orders, you will follow them without question, often in the dark as to how this fits together and why it is happening. But you must do it exactly as you were ordered, and always with the terrifying fear that someone might betray you. Is that faith, that trust, reasonable? Sometimes what the resistance leader is doing is obvious. He's helping some of your fellow resistance members. And you think, thank heavens, he's on our side. It's a good thing we have him. But sometimes it's not so obvious. The resistance leader is in a Gestapo uniform, and he's arresting some of your fellow resistance members. And you don't understand why. Because what you don't know is that behind the scenes he's releasing them and getting them safely out of Nazi territory. But you don't know that, and you never will know that. You have to obey and do. Only after the war is over do you find out what was really happening in all of that. That's what it means to walk by faith, isn't it? In this world in which we live. And to follow God, even when we don't always understand why God has put us where He's put us, even though we don't understand always why we have to go through what we're going through. Second principle this morning. We are pilgrims as we walk this land. Verse 4. So Abram went forth as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Now Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his nephew, and all their possessions which they had accumulated and the persons which they had acquired in Haran, and they set out for the land of Canaan. Thus they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed through the land as far as the site of Shechem to the oak of Morah. Now the Canaanite was then in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your descendants I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. Then he proceeded from there to the mountain on the east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord and called upon the name of the Lord. Abram journeyed on, continuing toward the Negev. Abram was a pilgrim. What is a pilgrim? Well, a pilgrim is someone who has left his homeland and is on his way to a new homeland. He's passing through one land on his way to his new homeland. He's moving always in life. So Abram crossed over the Euphrates River. He traveled south along the Orontes River until he reached the territory of Canaan. That's foreign country to Abram. He was not a Canaanite, yet he is surrounded everywhere by Canaanites. They don't look like him. They don't dress like him. They don't talk like him. He's different. You know what? Pilgrims are different. That's the nature of being a pilgrim. And God tells Abram that this will be his homeland for his descendants, although Abraham's never going to see that promise fulfilled in his life, is he? Forever he's going to live without seeing that promise fulfilled. He will live his whole life as a pilgrim. He lives near Shechem first, in the grove of oaks there in Morah. And then he moves to a place between Bethel and Ai. Ai means the ruin, and Abram lives here for a while. But you know what? Pilgrims are never really settled, are they? They are always moving. Somebody has called Abram a caravanner. He's always on the move. And so Abram moves to the Negev, down in the southern part of Israel. It's the southern region of the land of Canaan, really southwest of the Dead Sea. There were villages in all these areas, but we never get the impression that Abraham lives in the villages, do we? They're foreigners. He's a foreigner among them, and he wanders, he moves around. Now, there are two characteristics of a pilgrim that are important for us in this verse, in verse 8. First, pilgrims pitch their tents. The Bedouin today still do this. Pilgrims pitch their tents. You see that in verse 8. Everywhere he went, Abraham pitched his tent. Second, pilgrims build altars to the Lord. Two things. Pitch tents, build altars. The verbs are very instructive. When you pitch a tent, what do? You're setting up a temporary residence, right? Pitching a tent is the epitome of transience. Tents are movable residences. Tents are temporary living arrangements. Pilgrims don't put down roots. They hold all things loosely because this is not their homeland. Of all the residents in the land of Canaan at this time, Abraham was probably the most permanent because his descendants were promised this land forever, as long as history takes place, long after the Canaanites are gone. And yet Abram holds on to the least possessions. He doesn't own any land. He is a pilgrim in the land, though he is the most permanent of all because of God's promises. So the first mark of the pilgrim is that he pitches his tent in the land. The second mark of a pilgrim is that he builds altars to the Lord. A tent was temporary. An altar, a stone altar, was permanent. Everywhere that Abram went, he built stone altars to God. And we see two of them, actually, in these verses. So pilgrims focus on establishing temporary residence, but spiritual permanence. Pilgrims put down their roots spiritually. They invest in God's kingdom work. That's the altars of God, not man's possessions and the things of this world. Those are the two characteristics, then, of a pilgrim. And we Christians are pilgrims in this world. This is not our home. Our citizenship, Paul tells us in the New Testament, is in heaven. That's our homeland. We are pilgrims here. But truthfully, we tend to live like residents, don't we? We do just the opposite of Abram. We build our residences and pitch our altars. The permanent parts of our lives are the homes we build. The temporary parts of our lives are the spiritual commitments we make, the investments we make in God's work. Church? I can take it or leave it. I can always find another one. Service for the Lord? That's the least important aspect of my life. So what we do is we cling to our things. We hold God's work loosely. Exactly the opposite of living by faith like Abraham. God calls us to hold things loosely and Him tightly. My parents are the greatest examples of this truth in my life. I know most of you have heard me tell of their example, but it's worth repeating here. My mother was born in Aroostook County, Maine. Anybody here from Aroostook? Yeah, I know there's some people here from Aroostook County, Maine, right? Born in Aroostook County, Maine, way up in the potato fields near the Canadian border. In fact, she was once nominated for a beauty contest to become Miss Potato Blossom Queen. And yes, apparently there was such a beauty contest in those days. Her father was an alcoholic. And she and her mom and father were divorced because of the alcoholism. She never really knew him well. She was raised by a single mom during the years of the Depression in northern Maine. Hearing God's call, she got on a bus up in Aroostook County and took that bus in 1949 to travel to Providence, Rhode Island to go to Bible school. Single girl. There she met my dad, and they were married after college. He had been brought up in the farm country of Long Island, New York, back when Long Island, New York was mostly farm country, which it's not today. Together they went off to seminary, and then with two little boys, they set out for the land of Pakistan in 1957. I was 3 years old. We traveled by freighter. Couldn't afford passenger service. The trip took 28 days on a freighter. Now, on a freighter, there's not a whole lot to do. In fact, my parents would put us in little harnesses because they were afraid we'd fall off the freighter. They served the Lord in the sin desert of Pakistan, where the temperature reached 120 degrees in the daytime. That's a far cry from Aroostook County, Maine. My parents always said, hold all things loosely. And they practiced it. When we had to return to America after my mom got so ill that she almost died there, they left virtually all of their earthly possessions in 55-gallon drums in the country of Pakistan, never to see them again. But everywhere they went in Pakistan, they established churches and Bible studies where people followed the Lord. Outposts of God's kingdom in this world. Altars, if you will, to God. They were pilgrims in the land. One of my earliest memories as a child is riding in the back seat of the Volkswagen bus that we traveled in. We're coming back late at night from one of the villages, doesn't matter which one, where Dad had been preaching and working with people. It's dark, and I fall asleep in the back of the Volkswagen bus, and I wake up, and I hear someone singing, and in the front, there are two people singing, Mom and Dad, riding in the two front seats, and they're singing, "This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. If heaven's not my home, then Lord, what will I do? Oh, the angels beckon me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore." That's Abraham faith. That is a pilgrim. Are you living as a pilgrim in this world? Am I? Third principle. We are failures as we follow our plans. We are failures as we follow our plans. Verse 10. Now there was a famine in the land, so Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. It came about when he came near to Egypt that he said to Sarai, his wife, "See now, I know that you are a beautiful woman. And when the Egyptians see you, they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, but they will let you live. Please say that you are my sister, so that it may go well with me because of you, and that I may live on account of you." It came about when Abram came into Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. Pharaoh's officials saw her and praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. Therefore, he treated Abram well for her sake, and gave him sheep and oxen and donkeys and male and female servants and female donkeys and camels. But the Lord struck Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. Then Pharaoh called Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister, so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife, take her and go." Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they escorted him away with his wife and all that belonged to him. So famine leads Abram to take his whole clan and travel to Egypt. Now famine is a major problem in the ancient world, especially in the Middle East, and particularly in the land of Canaan, where they're so dependent upon rainfall. It's a very dry climate most of the time, and they're very dependent on rainfall. But the breadbasket of the Middle Eastern world was Egypt. Because of the Nile River, they never had to worry much about rainfall or water, and so crops and everything could be grown well. So people in the Middle East in times of famine would migrate to Egypt to get food and crops and water and everything that they needed. Some have criticized Abram. They've said, well, it was a lack of faith in going to Egypt, a lack of faith in God's promises. Perhaps there's some truth to that, but I don't think it was necessarily a lack of faith for Abram to take his family and go to Egypt for food. It was what? A reasonable, here we're back to that word, and prudent thing to do, right? It was something that made sense. And God had not prohibited him. God had not said, you can't go to Egypt. So when Abram looked at the problem, this seemed like a reasonable thing to do. Yet there is also the indication that Abram did not pray about this decision. We're not told he did anyway. So I think we can conclude that Abram was doing what we most often do in a crisis, in a problem. We make our plans. They are reasonable plans. They are not necessarily sinful plans. They're good plans. They're logical, reasonable. This is what makes sense. We think we have it figured out. And if we have it figured out, then we don't really need God. So Abram is moving ahead to solve the problem he faced. But the problem becomes severe as he nears Egypt. Abram becomes afraid. He is afraid that somehow someone will see his beautiful wife, Sarai, and kill him so that they can take her away. Now, let's stop for just a minute. How old is Sarai at this point? She's 65 years old. She's 65, and some question the story for that reason. We must remember that Sarai lived to be 127, right? So her 65 is more like a woman of 35 or 40. Jewish writers, by the way, rabbis, consider Sarai to be one of the three most beautiful women the world has ever seen. Apparently, she was very beautiful. At any rate, Abram fears for his life as he approaches Egypt, and there is good reason for the fear. Egypt has been a powerful empire now for a long time. The great pyramids in Giza were built 400 to 500 years before Abraham lived. This has been a world empire. But Egypt is going through an intense period of political instability and economic unrest, if you will. Many Egyptians, and we actually have documents from this period of time stating this, many Egyptians hated the illegal aliens that were coming into their land. Sound kind of familiar, I suppose. But all of these people would come into the land of Egypt, and they would take the jobs and the crops and the food and everything like that. And many residents of Egypt were coming to hate these illegal aliens. And there are documents from this period of time where people were writing about eliminating these people, about getting rid of them, about not allowing them into the country and fighting against them. That was the local sentiment against these illegal aliens. So Abram, as he gets near to Egypt, begins to get all of this, and he realizes this is not a safe environment. And so he concocts a scheme. He claims Sarai is his sister. Well, technically, she is. She is his half-sister. So it's a half-truth. But a half-truth is still a lie if we intend to deceive by it. So this was an intentional deception to calm his own fears. Abram could not possibly have foreseen what was going to happen with his lie. He thought they would just, you know, state this lie and they'd work their way through and then they'd leave and everything would be fine. But what starts out as a little white lie becomes a major deception when Pharaoh decides to take Sarai into his harem. Now, what does Abram do? Not only that, but Pharaoh is heaping him with servants and camels and donkeys and all kinds of wealth. And he's got to live with this lie, and Sarah's in the harem. What in the world is he going to do? Well, God does something. He strikes Pharaoh's household with plagues until eventually the truth comes out, and Pharaoh then confronts Abram about his lie. Now that's ironic, isn't it? Here is the father of faith being confronted by a pagan king about lying because he didn't have faith. How ironic is that truth? But you see, we fail. We fail every time we try to make our plans and our schemes take care of our problems instead of trusting God. We face a problem, don't we? You know this is the way it goes. We come up with a plan to solve that problem without God. Seems reasonable. Hey, I got this one, God. Got it under control here. Got a good plan in place to solve this problem. I can figure this one out. I don't need to bother you, God. You got bigger things to deal with in life. So we set out to implement our plan. And then the fears start rising up. And the fears lead us to deceive and maybe to lie to cover ourselves. And the end result is always a mess. Lies always lead to a mess. And it all starts when we trust our own plans instead of God's promises. What do you see in that slide?
An orange circle.
An orange circle. Anybody see something else? What? White space. So, somebody sees white space, somebody sees an orange circle. This is a, if you've ever gone to sales training or leadership training, this is a common technique used to teach a sales principle. And what is that? The average person, when they're asked that question, sees the orange circle. They see the problem, they don't see all of the white, the opportunities. All right, well, I would say what we do is we see the problem, we don't see God's promises. We don't see what God is doing when we're focused on the orange circle of life. We forget that God has promised not to abandon us. God will not give up on you. God's still in control. But what we see is the orange circle. What we see is the problem. And what happens is we obsess about the problem, don't we? We focus on that problem. And as we focus on the problem grows. It gets bigger and bigger until it's all consuming. We obsess about it. We research it. We work on it. We try to figure it all out. We are obsessed with the problem. And pretty soon we don't ever see the promises of God. That He's with us in this problem. That He has everything under control. And we don't trust His promises. What we should do is look at the problem. There's a real problem here. But look at our God. And take it to God. It's not wrong to plan, of course. It's not wrong to figure things out. God helps us in that process. But what do we start with? Not the problem, but the promises of God. God is with you. God can take care of whatever problem you're facing. He may not fix it the way you want it fixed, but He can take care of it with you. And you can trust Him. And we start to look at God's promises, not our problems. And that's faith. Genesis 1 through 11, we've looked at all of the makings of a world life view. Now in Genesis chapter 12, we're zeroing in on one man and the walk of faith. And as we zero in on this one man and his walk of faith, we need to learn what it means to walk by faith in our lives today. Faith means following God wherever He leads. whether it's big or small. Now, the danger of studying Abraham is that we will think of faith only in the big stuff, because he seems to deal with a lot of big stuff, right? But God is at work in us in the little stuff too. And it takes faith to walk with God in the little things of life and to listen to God as he leads us through the daily activities of our lives. And we must be ready to adjust our plans to follow his plans. That's faith. Bill Hybels, in his book, The Power of a Whisper, tells about a time when he and his wife Lynn had been in attendance at a funeral. They'd left the funeral and they were walking to their car in the parking lot, and he noticed a frail, elderly woman pulled into the nearby apartment complex. She parked her car and she began to take the grocery bags out of the car, struggling with each one of them. How about helping the woman with her groceries? The Holy Spirit seemed to impress on his mind. He brushed it aside. He had Lynn with him. They were busy. They had places to go. They just left this funeral. But he was reminded in his thought process about what he'd said to God that morning. God, he'd said, if there's something you'd like me to do, then just show me what you want me to do today. So he knew he had to obey. He said to Lynn, I've got this little pact going with God. I need to help that woman with her groceries for a minute. I don't know why, but I need to. So he went over. He asked if he could help her. She said, oh yes, she would greatly appreciate that. He said he got a hold of the bags and said there were about 30 pounds of fresh peaches in them. They were kind of heavy. And he's gathering these bags, and he said, okay, lead the way. And then he realized that there was a rope that roped off the driveway into the parking complex for the apartment complex there. And because they were doing construction work, so they had to walk around, and they walked through the yards there, which were all muddy and filled with water because of all the rain they'd had. So, and then he found out that this woman was very arthritic and she had emphysema, and about every 45 seconds to a minute she'd have to stop for a while to catch her breath. So he said the trip from the car to her apartment took 30 minutes. He said, in that time, I learned more about this woman than I could imagine as she shared her life story with me. Got to the apartment complex, got inside, put the things on the counter, got ready to leave, and she turned and she said, thank you. I have to believe that God put you in my life today to help me with this. And then he left. He writes, the whole deal felt so inglorious. The wet feet, the longer than expected trek, the lack of any earth-shattering results. So you thought the story is going to lead to something really spectacular. Nothing. And yet as I walked away from the apartment complex, something in my spirit felt right. God had whispered a simple instruction my way, and this time I had actually slowed down enough to listen. There's no greater feeling in the world than to hear and heed God's voice. See how powerful it is in our daily lives. How does God want to use you? What new directions does he want you to follow in life? How is he shifting things for you so that you need to go in some new way that you didn't really want to go before or hadn't thought of? Are you listening? Are you willing to go? Am I? That's walking by faith. Father, we confess that often we aren't really willing to walk by faith. We're busy Help us, Lord. Help us as we face new challenges, problems, situations in our lives. Help us to trust you in those situations and to walk daily with you and to listen to you as you guide our lives. For you want us to trust you and to walk by faith. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.